Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we talk guitar and rock history with our guest, Tony Conley, author of Rock Guitar Daily Blog, and Dan Boole, Commander-in-Chief at 65 Amps, better known as the President. Ladies and gentlemen, all hail the President. The Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Guitar Hummer at www.guitarhummer.com and Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio. And now here are your hosts, Mr. Jeff Floro, the Flow to the Izzo, and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. Hey, Scott, how are you doing? We got a great show tonight.
We do. We do. We haven't even had it yet, and we know that it's already great.
It's just, I got bunches of questions. Bunches.
I have a question about the Guitar Hummer, but we'll save that for later.
Well, we should talk about it. It's actually a very interesting little item, actually.
But well, let me, right now, since he mentioned it, let's play a spot for it so it can explain what it is, and maybe that'll answer your question. So hold on a second. Let me play that.
There's a product out called Guitar Hummer that's designed to give you vintage sound without the vintage weight. We all know the more a guitar is played, the better the sound. Guitar Hummer is a guitar stand that simulates play by sending gentle vibrations through your guitar as it sits. Swap your guitar stand for Guitar Hummer, and in just a few weeks, you will notice deeper, richer tone and improved sustain. But don't take our word for it. Try it for 60 days, and if you don't notice a marked difference, return it for a full refund. Go to guitarhummer.com for more information or to purchase.
There you go.
That's guitarhummer.com, guys.
Yes. And we just got the Scott just brought me over one of the Guitar Hummers, so we're going to try it on one of my new Martins.
And I'll be putting on an Epiphone. I'll be doing a YouTube video of before, 2 weeks, 1 month, and 2 months, something like that. And you can see and hear a difference. Well, we won't see a difference, but we'll hear a difference, I'm sure.
Yes.
I'm starting the seasoning process already. I'm already pulled out some Cajun season, but it's I'm very excited, actually.
So I to see what I live.
There you go.
Yeah. So what have been up to, Jeff, for the past week?
Well, I've been I've been really excited about this new show that you guys have been putting together. So I've been digging around and trying to figure out some interesting going through rock history and looking back at some of the stuff that I've seen firsthand. And so it's going to be interesting. I'll have some questions for these guys about some amps and different, speaker cabinets. We were just talking a little bit about speaker cabinets, so we'll talk about that. But otherwise, been playing that Les Paul that Monique had cleaned up for me. Been doing that, and I'm a little behind, but I tore apart my Strat, so the Strat's being worked on right now, restrung. So.
Well, I have actually, although I've been, knee-deep in poo diapers and pee diapers and all that stuff, and enjoying it, actually, much loving it, but I actually was able to put together the video I've been wanting to do for a very long time, my Monsters of Al Nico. So I'm pretty excited. 6 different Al Nico speakers, all tested out.
Yes, and I'm curious to see which one sounds the best.
Yeah, so I got 6 different speakers from Celestion, Eminence, Scumback, and Jensen. There we go. I'm just forgetting the last one there, but... So, very cool. I was actually really pleased with that.
And speaking of Al Nico, do you use the Al Nicos on
your use the Al Nicos, all Celestions. I use the Al Nico Gold and the Al Nico Blue.
Okay.
For one reason and one reason only is they have a warranty on them. So, I have to.
Well, no, but I mean, you don't use the ceramics on your amp?
I do. I mix them, actually. My standard cabinet is the ceramic G12H30, which I think they're calling the 40th anniversary now or something like that.
Yeah.
They've changed the name. And then we use the Al Nico Blue in the low-powered cabinets and the Al Nico Gold in the high-powered.
When we did that, there's a video that Scott had done with you on it from the LA Amp Show. What were those speakers?
That cabinet, that was the producer.
Yeah.
And that was an Al Nico Gold, with the G12H30. So it's a ceramic magnet and the Alnico magnet. They kind of fill in each other's blanks really well.
Okay. Yeah, that sounded great. Check that video out on Selenium.
That was really well done, Scott, by the way.
Thank you.
Did you do that with your...
I did. Well, you were there.
I just don't remember the camera. You know,
he's
when
busy
people
playing.
Rock and roll, folks. No, he doesn't remember.
You know, when people are filming you all day. No.
Yes, I did. I did it with a little Canon camera.
That was really well done. I need to hire you out.
Hey, I would love the extra work. I have a kid now, so I need extra money.
And he does diapers, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm past the diaper phase. I'll be back in him in a few years, but... yeah. No, that looked really good.
Yeah.
Looked really, really good.
Well, the other one I did... Oh, no, I already talked about it last week. I did a bunch of them. I did 65 amps. I was busy.
Your dad did the steel guitar.
Yeah,
thing.
I did that one. I did Sweetwood guitars and BC Audio. So I got all the LA Talk... Or not LA Talk, or whatever they
are. LA Amp Show.
Yeah, LA Amp Show. All those are up, so you can see those. But, you know, of course, Dan Boole is the star of the show.
Yes. But all that came through the... Not the onboard mic with this, is there?
No. I always use a Zoom H4N as my little portable audio recorder.
Yeah, and it sounded really good.
Well, but then I connect that up to the Sennheiser 609 silver mic.
Right.
Yeah.
So. That's a good guitar mic.
And it really showed what you were talking about, the difference with the 6L6 and the EL34.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, because when you mic both those up, I usually mic them up with ribbon mics.
Yeah.
And I could hear the distinction between the two different kinds of tubes on your video really well.
Well, you know, the one thing I have to say, I used an SM57 because that's just what society tells me I should use, right?
Which is wrong, but yes.
Well, that's what I learned. My wife asked for, because I wanted to experiment with other different stuff, because us guitar players always are never very happy with what we have. Well, we're always happy, but we always want more, right? You know. But anyway, so I tried the Sennheiser 609,
mm-hmm. Great
and
mic, yeah.
I was blown away. It was actually what I heard in the room, because
for a $125 mic.
Yeah, it's pretty affordable. I mean, I was very impressed with that. I'm also impressed with the one I used, the 2035 from Audio Technica, mm-hmm. which is not bad too. I mean, they both, to me, present a truer representation of what you hear.
Yeah, I think a 57 highlights every annoying frequency of a guitar that you could ever imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna say that, but I mean. It just it
of course, we do want Shure as a sponsor on the show, and I mean that with love and respect.
Yeah. The 57 was used a lot as an engineer working in engineering different guitar groups and stuff.
Yeah.
It was really good because it was in that little pocket.
It's narrow, so you can fit it in a mix.
Right. Well. It was right. It did all the EQ you needed to do to get it to stand out.
And you can also drive nails with it, and it'll still work. So.
But Jeff Emmerich of that did all the a lot of the Beatles mm-hmm. stuff. Yeah. That's all he used on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
So before, I mean, we've kind of already got in the show here, but before we, before we totally started. If you guys want to call and harass the Commander-in-Chief and Tony Conley, then you can call 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815, or you can join us in our chat room and send pictures to Jeff. He is single, folks. So preferably, well, I don't know, women, but hey, you never know. It's California, so. Sorry. I'm in a little... And then, lastly, it is Veterans Day.
He's been home too long.
Yeah,
I'm a little cabin fevered, folks.
Yeah,
but,
I think so.
He's happy to be using big boy words now.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm seeing the outside world here. But it is Veterans Day, so happy Veterans Day to those folks
that did
their thing, and then for us.
To all the veterans, welcome home, and thanks for serving. But I'm pretty excited about there's a new show coming on LA Talk Radio here, and it's called Rock Ain't Near Dead Radio with these two guys.
Yes, and hopefully you guys will come join us quite a bit on that.
Oh, we'll come by and harass you. And,
absolutely.
And Scott will use big words.
Yeah.
Yes.
So. I use big words sometimes.
But anyway, can you give us a little bit of a synopsis, then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of the guitar stuff, but basically of what the show's about?
Well, this all started months ago, probably back in May or June. I was watching Dan's podcast that he does every week, Lunch with Dan Boole, 65 Amps, and there was a great conversation going on about you know, is rock dead? Mainstream rock, you know, you hear basically garbage on mainstream radio quite often, and you know, I'm in a position where I've heard more great rock in the last 2 years than I've heard in the past 10 years. So no, I don't think rock's dead at all. It's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, if you look back where it started, if you look where it's at, and Lord only knows where it's going, but it's like any great genre of music, jazz, blues, whatever, they mature. They evolve. That's what's happening with rock. And that's mm-hmm. what we're going to try to kind of unearth and get into and have some fun with.
Well, Tony and I had a really extended conversation over the course of a few of my Wednesday shows, and we have a little different perspectives on it. Some of it overlaps, some of it doesn't. But, you know, I was trying to figure out what's missing from rock and roll that keeps it from being mainstream music right now. You know, we were trying to analyze it. And Tony's a little more of a defender of modern rock and roll than I am, and he points out a lot of really good bands and a lot of really good artists that are actually fantastic players, but we're trying to figure out why is that not in the mainstream, and there's economic reasons, there's the whole digital revolution, there's all the sorts of things, there's the fact that, you know, my 10-year-old daughter looked at me this year and said, "Dad, I'm not sure I like rock and roll. That's what you and Grandpa listen to." And I kind of went, "Yeah, okay, fair enough. I would not sit around and listen to what my dad and my grandfather listen to." But nonetheless, I'm, you know, a rock and roll musician, and rock and roll is my religion, and I'm just heartbroken that rock and roll is not mainstream music anymore. So Tony and I went off on a bunch of, dare I say, semi-philosophical rants about why and what are the causes, and there's miles and miles of discussion about it, and we drew in a lot of other people in the music business. And I think my favorite quote I got, who was the artist that gave you the quote about the Renaissance?
Well, that was Greg Lake. He's fond of talking about the age of shared music. I had a great conversation with Greg about a year ago, and he got into this deep thing because I asked him about where rock was today, and he said, well, you have to understand, you know, that when Emerson, Lake, and Palmer started, you know, we had the Hendrix, we had the Beatles, we had the Stones, we had the Who. Well, you damn well better sound original. So, you know, we took our own little take on what we did. We liked classical music. We liked a lot of vocals. We liked intricate instrumentation. We became something. And at that time, you know, he said, when I got the new Beatle record, I had 40 people to my apartment, and we sat and we listened to Hey Jude, and it was a shared experience. He said the minute you get into, you know, the Sony Walkman, earbuds, it becomes a completely different thing. It becomes, you know, you lose the concept of kind of a thing of 100 monkeys. You kind of get a disconnect, and there's no longer an era where we sit around and share music.
That's true. That's true. Because the other thing too is, in those days, you put an album on and you listen to it. Now,
right,
you're driving in your car, you're walking around, you have music on. It's like,
and there's
not a focus on it.
The social element is gone, because I remember being exposed to certain bands that I ended up ultimately really loving. But my first exposure to them, it wasn't positive. Like, I remember the very first time I sat down and really listened to a Hendrix record. And I was young. I mean, I was 8, 9 years old. And I remember this just sounding kind of scary. But all the older kids in the room were really enjoying it. So I sat there and went, yeah, this is awesome. And, you know, the 10th or 12th time I heard, you know, yeah, Hendrix greatest hits of just LP playing in someone's house, I started to go, oh, right, yeah, this is great. And when you're not sharing music like that, you sit around and listen to stuff on your iPod and go, next, 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 next.
Well,
you don't listen to music in the same way.
I argue that it, you know, maybe it's the Walkman that started it, but I think it's iTunes that destroyed. Because, everybody loves iTunes and its accessibility, but it's ruined the album. It's ruined album art. It's ruined the concept album. I just think it's just ruined music.
Another thing, as soon as Jeff said album, the thing I always go back to is the CD era, and all of a sudden an artist had to put 75 minutes of original music on an album. Now, as we're sitting here in this room, we could probably name almost all the great double albums in about 3 minutes. And all of a sudden, artists had to record a double album every time they did an album. So, and the attention span of the listener had to go from 35 to 40 minutes to 75. So
that's right, because a record can only go about 20 minutes max, or the grooves. It was too much technically.
Yeah. Well, it's also the concept of the album being a unit. Now it's just a collection. I mean, you've seen all the little memes on the internet, you know. Here's a Queen record, two songwriters, one producer. Here's a Beyonce record, 32 songwriters, seven producers. That's not a unit when you're making records like that. That's just a collection of singles.
Yeah.
It's not an album, you know. It's
plus, I'm a bit annoyed with the mainstream artist and then featuring somebody else. I know that it sells more records, but it's kind of
annoying. A marketing ploy.
Just I don't see Dream Theater featuring. I don't know.
Well, when Clapton played on, what was it, Abbey Road?
Yeah, they. Well, there was.
He's not even listed.
But there was a reason, because the record companies would go nuts. They basically just hushed it up and.
Yeah.
But the other thing too is these resurgences of different. Remember, maybe was it 15? It's kind of scary. 15 or 20 years ago, there was a. 50s music became big again.
Yeah, in the 80s, yeah.
And then 60s music, and then 70s music. What I found, like when the 60s music and people were into like the mod stuff, like The Who was the original, one of the original groups of that, when they played the stuff, they used the same instruments, they basically used the same type of music structure. But the thing that was missing, and I think it was a big thing in the 60s and the 70s, there was a lot of cultural stuff going on.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the protest song. For example, just the melding of different styles. The Beatles were introducing a lot of Indian music, a lot of world music. Mm-hmm. And all of that stuff was being influenced and influencing all the groups into the 70s, where you had the more mellow stuff all the way to the prog rock stuff. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff was influenced by all this culture expanding. And everybody was like, you know, the Moody Blues were using sitars, and just like the Beatles were, and they were all friends, and they were all doing different, the Stones.
Remember the big phrase back then was the generation gap.
Right. I remember that.
It was just, that was the whole thing. This is a product of the generation gap. It's the children rebelling against their parents. Hell, I sit down and listen to the Rolling Stones with my dad now. He's 70.
The interesting thing now is, and tell me if you've ever heard one now, have you heard a protest song anymore? And it's kind of funny, because a lot of the guys that are protest guys are kind of uber conservative now.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Actually, there was plenty of protest songs when George W. Bush was president. Not that I agreed with them, but I'm just saying there was plenty. There was a lot.
Ry Cooter did an amazing protest record 2 years ago.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's just an amazing set of songs. And they're truly protest songs. And, you know, I had a chance to talk to Ry about 2 years ago, and he had just done the album, and he said, he goes, I don't think anybody even really realized what I just did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not mainstream at all.
Yeah, it doesn't get the attention. But that's if you look to the mainstream, you might not find it.
But the record labels are part of the mainstream establishment now. But they weren't back then.
Record companies are kind of nothing now.
Yeah.
Well, they still own the mainstream, but one of the things about record companies is they've become a lot more like iTunes. They don't invest in development of artists. They create artists.
Yeah.
Did you see the debacle at the CMAs? Did you see the thing about the ACA at the CMAs? And my point about that was, I don't care who says what. My take on that was, the artists weren't saying that. They were saying what they were being told to say by the record companies.
Mm-hmm.
Record companies do not develop talent now. Record companies create talent. They tell the talent what the talent will be. And that's one of the reasons the mainstream's a little weak.
Well, the whole concept of artists and repertoire, which most people, the A&R guy, doesn't exist. I mean, that left in the early 70s.
Well, the whole concept of even getting a record deal, like I was trying to do that in the 80s and got a little bit of traction for a minute with a band that I was in. And the rule of thumb was, there, if you didn't have a hit record by your third album, you were on thin ice.
Yeah.
Now it's if your first single doesn't get a heavy download, you're done. You know, like they used to have this thing called a development deal.
Yeah.
Which doesn't exist. They took us to New York. My band went to New York, and they put us in rehearsals and gigs and made us play our butt off for 6 months and to develop you. And you look at some of these huge artists we have now whose first records were flops, and now they're immense. Bruce Springsteen.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. I talked to a guy that worked at Capitol. This was years ago. And somebody, by mistake, sent one of the masters of the Beatles record to an A&R guy at Capitol, and he rejected it. It's pretty... I mean, and they were. This was after Sgt. Pepper, so they were, like, huge.
Yeah.
I think it might have been Abbey Road. I'm not sure. But, of course, the guy got fired, but he actually sent it back with a, you know, I'm really sorry, but we're really not interested in this.
Didn't they get rejected by, like, 10 labels?
Well, maybe in the beginning, but, I mean, this was when they were at their peak.
Yeah. Everyone should know who they were.
They weren't good until they got the second Paul McCartney in there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, but, Tony and I are going to just dig into stuff like that, and we both know a lot of people from different areas of the music business, and just kind of, you know, talk about what's going on in the music business, hopefully get some interesting people in and stir it up a little bit, say things that maybe aren't completely safe.
Well, that's okay. That's part of rock and roll.
And me coming through the little more hopeful side of the thing, a little more, you know, I tend to see things through a little rosier frame glasses, perhaps, rosier lens glasses. Any guest we have on, I'm going to ask them, you know, not just about where they came from historically, musically speaking, their influences and how they got to be, who they got to be, or where they are today. But I'm going to ask them, you know, what new bands are you listening to?
Yeah.
You know, and I always get that from people I talk to, and I discover new music all the time. I have so much on my desk right now to listen to that it gives me a headache. I'm 7 interviews behind transcribing them because it's good stuff that I want to get out there. And I have too much on my desk to get to. Mm-hmm. I have a new baby, too, so...
And then we're going to do a thing, so...
Yeah,
so... We're going to take up more time.
Well, you know, one of the things you're talking about, the good side of it, and this is kind of, I think, is a good thing about it. I remember playing, I mean, a lot of, for example, distortion in amps. There's a lot of stuff that back then people just didn't know. Even Hendrix was... You know, I'll try this amp. It's okay. I mean, he was mixing amps. He used mostly Marshalls, but he used Suns. He used Fenders. And a lot of that distortion was because they just had to get it out. They were
on
the stage.
Had to get it loud, yeah.
But now, I mean, it's a science. And, so, you know, if you want a certain type of Strat sound, if you want like a 50s, it's a maple neck, Alder body. 50s, I mean, they got the winding down to the, you know, exactly. And the same thing with amps, the type of distortion. I mean, that video that you did for the LA Amp Show that's on Selenium, the Selenium channel, I mean, it's down to a science. I mean, where you're controlling that tone. You're getting radical distortion. You're getting a lot of... You're getting a really pristine, glassy, clean sound, dialable. I mean, I know from playing back in the day, it was like that's like unbelievable that you could just by a foot switch go from and control the volume where it's not, you know, just cranking up the amp and all of a sudden the dBs just go.
Oh, yeah.
It is literally like a Ferrari that gets great gas mileage. That's usually my analogy when guys go, hey, I want, you know, I sold amps for 20 years. And it's like, I goes, I want to sound like Metallica. And I also want to have a pristine clean channel. And I go, well, you're going to buy 2 amps?
That's how I always did it.
And there was always that compromise. And now technology and, you know, some great innovation. I'm fantastically lucky to get to know guys like Dan Boole. A couple weeks ago, I did a great interview with a guitar builder named Terry McInturf. And he told me a great story about nitrocellulose lacquers. And he said the guys who build guitars today don't realize they're not working with the same set of properties when they buy nitro. And he actually got an old gallon of Nicholas Nitro from the 50s that still was active, and he actually combines 3 different types of nitro to get to a similar chemical equation to put on his guitars. So we're at a point where the technology has never been better. Now we just need a new Hendrix.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's just like the boom in the home studio. I remember when TIAC came out with, I used to have a 4-track and I used to play. And, no, before that, the reel-to-reel one. You're talking about the Porta Studio.
Oh, yeah, I had the little...
No, I had the big guy.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because you... It opened up so much. It, as you know, starting out as a session player, it really got my chops together trying to sync. Because the first time I tried that thing, I started playing guitar. Okay, I'm an overdub, and like the beat was all over the place. Uh-huh. You know, there was no click track or whatever. But and it was kind of funny trying to follow it. But the thing is it opened up so everybody can play. Mm-hmm. And now you're seeing stuff even on MP3s, you know, on iTunes or Amazon. That
I have an 8-track recorder on my phone.
That's kind of cool.
That's killer.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent tens of thousands of dollars making demo tapes in the 80s on 8 and 16-track Studer machines, you know, but cheap boards and cheap studios. And I can pull out my iPhone. I can plug in a little microphone to it. I do it with my daughters. You know, like my daughter has to sing a song for school. I'll lay it down on the ground. I'll put 3 guitar tracks on it and something else. And mm-hmm. then I go, here, just go to school and sing over this.
Yeah.
Yep. And it sounds amazing. Sounds
yeah.
great.
But that technology is now accessible to everybody. But like you said, now it's time for the... Now there's, you know, it's not a technical problem. It's now a creative problem, you know. Do you have the creative chops to make something interesting?
Right.
But that only happens every so often. It doesn't, you know, we haven't had a Beatles since the last Beatles. You know, yes. It takes time, and there will be another. There always have been. Mm. And the thing I think that is important is to create a situation and when, you know, the next musical genius comes along the lines of a Hendrix or the Beatles, you have to have a situation that's ready for them. You mm-hmm. have to perpetuate the industry. You have to keep it moving. You know, and we're taking it even to the point where, you know, today we were in recording studios trying to find a studio with a good drum sound because, you know, we're talking about putting out some records. And, you know, I'm talking about putting together some projects. Instead of sitting around complaining about, oh, this is terrible, oh, that's terrible, do something about it. Go out and build a better amp. Go out and figure out how to finish a guitar. You know, and people are doing it on a small scale.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of people
there's
are
a
playing.
Great resurgence.
There's a resurgence in that aspect.
We're resisting the Taylor Swift, Carrie Underwood vortex.
What about Miley? I'm waiting for you to mention Miley. But
Miley. Miley's maligned. Should we go into that?
No. I want you to save that for your show because I think your Miley theories are great. But
have I told you my Miley theory?
Yes, I have heard your Miley
theories.
Okay,
good.
But you need to save that for your show. People need to listen to that. Now let me ask you guys this question. I you're saying you're looking for the next Hendrix, and I don't mean to even compare this guy because he is African American. He's not the next Hendrix because he's different, but I think he is. To me, the most exciting thing I've seen in a long time, Gary Clark Jr. But I think he's a great example of how record companies can destroy him. Because if you listen to his album, it's a great album, but it is a hodgepodge of weird mixes. It's R&B song, then a super awesome blues tone, to the next like fuzz sound.
It's and a then collection even those, of singles, isn't
it's,
it?
Yeah, it's basically a producer has gone in and overproduced him,
or,
I think.
Or 5 producers.
Yeah, well, yeah. So that would be my critique of his album, but him live is amazing. It was ridiculously amazing. I've seen him twice now, and he has no frills, no super lights. Hell, when I saw him at the Wiltern, he didn't even have a spotlight guy.
Really?
It was amazing, and it was just ridiculously good.
I'm going to give you a name that probably, you know, not a lot of people know right now.
Write it in
a year from now, yeah. No, I have.
I've
had it in the envelope. I'm taking it out of the envelope this evening. There's a fella. He's about 22, 23 years old. His name's Andrew 50 Watt.
All right.
New York City singer-songwriter. He's currently in a project that, if I talk about, I'm going to get in a whole lot of trouble. But if you know me well, it wouldn't be hard to figure out which project he's getting involved in. They started their rehearsals in Hollywood today. A year from now, you're going to know who Andrew Watt is, and he's going to be fronting a power trio that, you know, is going to blow minds. You know, it's like, and if you get out there and dig, you can find this stuff. You know, is he Hendrix? No, he's not Hendrix. I mean, but Hendrix wasn't Chuck Berry.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing with Gary Clark Jr. that I like about him is he's not nearly as a fancy of a guitar player as like a Steve Ray Vaughan or Hendrix. Still quite creative and very, you know, his tone and the sounds he gets are quite unique and amazing. But his singing, I think, blows them away. I mean, well, Stevie Ray Vaughan was a hell of a singer.
Well,
Hendrix was not as great of a singer.
Last year this time, Gary Clark was playing a show in Columbus, Ohio, and, you know, in the back of the room, standing there watching him was Clapton.
Yeah, when they put him on his Crossroads tour,
mm-hmm.
which isn't easy to get onto. So.
Very fun. Well, I think one of the neat things I wanted to go back to, because we keep mentioning Hendrix, and since I'm an amp guy, you know, the main innovation that Hendrix did, in my humble opinion, was he was the first guy to play the amp.
That's right.
He was the first guy to lean the guitar into the speakers and make it squeal and then control it and turn it into something. He was the first guy who realized that if you're on the neck pickup and you're at a certain angle at an amplifier that's 130 decibels right behind you, it will do pretty interesting things if you're smart enough to learn how to control it. Before that, everybody played guitar. Hendrix was the first
guy. Every component of what he was using was an instrument.
And he played his pedals. It wasn't his sound. He used the pedal as an effect. Now guys want their pedals to be their sound. But he was the first guy to play the amp. You know, it was important to him. And I had a conversation with, of all people, Jim Marshall about this. At our first NAMM show, I went to Jim Marshall and said, okay, so I'm shamelessly ripping you off like everyone here is. But, you know, what are some of the biggest mistakes I can make? And one of the first things he said was, never give away an amp. And he goes on this big, huge story about Hendrix. And, you know, because I asked him, why do you think Hendrix played your amp so much? He said two reasons, one of which is they never broke down. Okay, if you can buy that. But also that they were loud enough for him to do what he wanted to do. And then he's the guy, the first time I ever heard that saying, said he was the first guy to actually play the amp. Said, you'd take a Fender and crank it up that loud and do that. It doesn't work. You take an Ampeg and crank it up that loud, it just squeals like a banshee. You take a Marshall and turn it up that loud, you can start doing things with it. And so we're looking for a guy that goes for that step. You know, Hendrix made that big, bold step of what is he doing? How's he getting that sound? I think guys like Eddie Van Halen, you know, the last time I remember being stunned by a guitar player, listening to him do the two-handed work before there was the internet and YouTube and everything, you sat there and how does he get that sound? What on earth is he doing? You know. And so
he had gotten that gain. The other guys, the Who too, were the other ones that actually I think worked with Marshall in developing those big amps, because I think they broke before Hendrix. Though they used feedback, they didn't go. Hendrix just took it. So
they just used it as a shock thing. They didn't use it too musically.
Right.
I heard from Jim Marshall because I asked him. You know, I had a good long conversation with him and I had the same exact conversation with Derek Underdown from Vox and asked them both why did they end up going with high watts. I said, because we quit giving them free amps. Like apparently, you know, the Who started out with Vox. And the Vox guys gave them everything they wanted, but they just broke them all on purpose. And they'd come in and say, we need another amp, mate. And after a while, they said, no, we're not giving you any more free gear. And they went to Jim Marshall, and he did it for about 6 months before he told them to go to hell. And then Dave Reeves finally said, well, I'll build something so strong you can't break it. And that was the high watt.
I saw they were using
1-inch thick wood and military steel chassis and all. He couldn't trash them. Might have to replace a speaker. You know, that was about it.
Yeah, no, they. But that was another thing too back then. I mean, the equipment, even the Fenders. I was always had good luck with my Fenders. They, you know, my old Cream Bandmaster. I blew a
great
pilot light in a fuse. Though at the very beginning, I lost a transformer.
Mm-hmm.
It was just defective. It wasn't because I was cranking it up. But after that, that amp is... I had to recap it 40 years later, but
well,
it's fine. But
normal
it's everything's fine. But the quality of the Marshall amps, they did take a beating.
They're rugged. You know, like not to go into amp nerddom, but, you know, the Fender stuff was made out of pine. And it was not as heavy, and the Marshalls were made out of Baltic birch with finger joints on it.
Yeah.
And it was hard to break those cabinets. That's why that basket weave cabinet is so sought after now, because it's made like a tank. And it just lasted. That's why those guys used all that gear back then for the most part. It didn't break down.
Unless you're at Winterland.
Yeah, right.
You were mentioning playing the amp. Another guy that does that now, I think, a lot is Jeff Beck. Watched him, there's a Blu-ray disc of him playing at, I forget the name of the club, but he's...
Oh, that's the one that's on HBO.
Ronnie Scott's?
Yeah, Ronnie Scott's.
It's amazing. And Clapton sits in with him,
I mean, some of the stuff that he's doing, and he's just using a pretty much standard Marshall.
50-watt Marshall.
He's getting some amazing tone out of that.
Now, Beck's a wizard. Have you seen Beck live? Have you gone here to watch him live?
I saw him play with Beck Bogart Epicy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Try to go see Jeff every time he comes into town because it's a kind of music that's experienced, not so much listened to. And because I listen to Jeff Beck records a little bit, and it's no big deal. But you go to the concert, and if you're a guitar player and you don't get a tear in your eye, you're just not human.
Yeah.
The last time I went there, I went there with Peter Stroud, my business partner, who's an amazing guitar player, and John Shanks, the producer, who's also an incredible guitar player, and I went with Lyle Workman, who might be the most astonishing human I've ever seen pick up the instrument. He's just mind-boggling. And all these guys, me, I'm humbled by anybody. It doesn't matter. These guys were all completely humbled watching Jeff Beck. We went backstage, or the VIP area at the Greek, got to meet him for a second, and we were all sitting around trying to apply an adjective to what we had just experienced, and nobody could come up with it. And Lyle Workman, of all people, says, we're just guitar owners. I went, really? You say that? Jeff Beck is just a freak of nature.
Just to give you an idea, he's touring right now with Brian Wilson.
Yeah, I heard about that. I haven't seen that
show. And Brian Wilson's saying this is amazing. He's just blown away.
Yeah. All the clips I've seen have been amazing. They have been... Beck, and it's great because there was this whole Beck resurgence because there was 20 years where he didn't do much.
Yeah. Well, and he was pretty active. I just saw on La La Land Records, they do a lot of soundtrack reissues. They reissued Days of Thunder, Tom Cruise's movie. Mm-hmm. The big claim to fame of that movie was basically it was the first DTS movie, for some trivia.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway.
And Tom Jeff, Cruise is an enemy.
You know, Tom Cruise, it was called Top Car because it was basically Top Gun driving. But the thing is, Hans Zimmer did the score. Jeff Beck did the guitar work. Credit. It blew me away when I saw it.
No, he's a wizard. Absolute wizard. For all of you youngsters listening, you have to go see Jeff Beck before he doesn't come around anymore.
It's true.
Yeah.
Let's take a break real quick, and we'll be right back. We got some more questions for our guests, Dan and Tony. Hang on 1 second.
Do you want to get the best possible tone from your acoustic instrument? Guitar Hummer is a guitar stand that does more than just rest your guitar. It creates a gentle but continuous vibration that is equivalent to playing your instrument all day, every day. This concentrates years of seasoning into mere weeks, improving tone and sustain. You may not be able to afford a vintage guitar, but you now can achieve vintage sound. But don't take our word for it. Try it for 60 days, and if you don't notice a marked difference, return it for a full refund. Go to GuitarHummer.com for more information or to purchase.
It's fantastic.
Well, that was all about GuitarHummer.com. One of our other sponsors is Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio, who happens to carry 65 amps.
That's right.
So not only could you help out our sponsors, Sweetwater, but you could also help out our guest, Mr. Commander-in-Chief Dan Boole.
Well, Sweetwater, we resisted the large retailers for a long time because we're a handmade L.A., California thing. Mm-hmm. And the Sweetwater guys actually sold me. You know, because we're kind of known for a little bit of neurotic, bend-over-backwards customer service. And I thought they were just like all the big retailers. Yeah, thanks for the money. See you later. Good luck. And they gave me the whole pitch about how you get assigned a sales engineer. These guys go to, 11 weeks of school? 8 hours a day. They go to school for 11 weeks. I saw Sweetwater University. I went there to Indiana and checked it out. Tony went with me, documented the trip. It was really fun. And these guys that answer the phone, they actually know what they're talking about. And so when you call them and say, hey, I'm looking for a cathode biased amp that gets a mid-period Beatles thing, blah, 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 and I play this kind of guitar, the guy goes, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And they have to learn all of our gear and take a test on it before they can sell it. They have to show that they know my whole line. They know the basics of each amp. I had to create a one sheet for them. and they have to memorize it and pass a test before they can pick up the phone and say, yeah, I can sell you 65. So it's amazing.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, the salesperson I have, Delvin is who I use, but
I know Delvin.
Delvin's a good guy. I actually was purchasing a guitar from them in January, and it was a 52 replica of Les Paul. Now, I'm not a big fan of 50s necks, but I played
that.
That
big bridge on it.
Yeah, it does, but it's made the way Les Paul wanted it and patented it. It's the reverse, so you can actually mute it. But anyways, but I had played that at NAMM, and I fell in love with the guitar, and it wasn't that big 50s neck. It was still bigger than a 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And told him the serial number I wanted. The dude pulled it and played it for like half an hour and told me exactly what the neck was like. And
you know, I saw their...
I trusted him on it.
I saw their...
It worked out quite well.
I saw their thing at their factory. Have you ever seen it? Every guitar that comes in there, they unbox it.
Yep.
Set it up. Polish the frets, set the intonation. Even though it comes from the factory, supposedly set up, whatever. Every single guitar that comes through, they have a huge shop with a bunch of guys in there. They're setting the intonation perfectly. They're making the neck straight. It's an amazing operation.
Yeah, I think there's 55 separate things they check with every guitar that comes in and out their door.
Which is more than the manufacturers do.
Yeah. you're pretty thorough with your amp.
Yeah, but I'm a neurotic freak. and I mean that with due love and respect.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to say, I mean...
he agrees, definitely.
I agree, because, you don't like a lot of tubes. Like, you have issues with tubes.
Well, they actually meet the definition of what it is, I think.
Like, see, I just think you're... I've never seen anyone that says that high amount of failure.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I think... So that must mean you are really, really, really picky.
Well, I'll give you the analogy. So
maybe picky's not a good word.
You go to a steakhouse and you say, hey, I would like a 20-ounce porterhouse, medium rare. And they bring you a ribeye that's burnt. And the guy says, what? It's beef. Would you accept it?
No.
Because you're paying a premium for a porterhouse that's really nice, and they just bring you a ribeye that looks like a car ran over it. That's what happens in the tube world. I'd like a 12AX7. Okay, well, this looks like a 12AX7, but it don't act like one. It don't measure like one. I'd like to return this to you, please.
I have to agree with you, because I've experienced original RCA tubes.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I think they were made before you were born, Scott.
Real RCA.
They are. There was a big difference in the sound.
I was born in 1942. What do you mean?
Yeah. But Scott's on the metric system.
Yeah. In dog years.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I...
It did sound different.
I'm kind of a smart aleck, but I just mean it in that spirit. But... No, modern tubes just don't meet the definition of what they're supposed to be. So I just kind of go, no, look, I ordered a 6V6. This is a 6K6 if I measure it correctly. And,
well, you know, I mean, I kind of tease you, but I have to say...
No, I'm a good sport. No.
But I'm just saying it's showing quite in your amps, because your amps are ridiculously good sounding.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
I mean, I want to say that it was my great audio quality and recording skills that I had when I recorded that at the LA Amp, but I think it was actually your amp that just sounded good.
No, it was just you did a great job. You did a great job.
The way you manipulate the tubes, and at the end of the thing, I'm looking at the amp. I'm putting my hand over the amp. That amp was not hot, and you were cranking that thing.
That had been on since 9:30 in the morning.
That was amazing. Yeah. That he was able to what he's doing with the current. It's getting all the distortion you want, but it's not killing the amp.
So I got the prototype in my car for the next producer. I should have brought it up and shown you. It's four EL84s.
Well, you know what you should do?
Bring it on the show.
Or you should have me and I'll shoot a video of it.
Do it. Come on over. Why don't you guys come over to my show?
Yeah. On Wednesdays?
Wednesday at noon over in Van Nuys.
Fortunately,
Studios.
I have a daytime job.
It's called a gig.
Yeah.
I'll have to come.
Fortunately, I have to pay bills.
Yeah, darn it. I know Bill, and he rides my bike too. Yeah.
Now, but, you know, we can do it some other time.
So, when does your new show start?
Tentatively, the first week of December on Saturday evening at 8:00.
Yeah, I forgot what day what number day that is. What is that? I can look on my calendar.
That would be the 7th, I think.
7th, I believe.
Oh, okay. So a day that will live in infamy.
Pearl Harbor Day. Veterans Day today, and then you're going to be on Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Man, you guys are just all...
So, and we can't play copyrighted material on the show, because I'm saying we should open it up with I Think I'm Turning Japanese. But that might not work.
We'll figure something
out. Does the FCC come down really hard on you guys?
There's no FCC. We're not on the airwaves.
No. So. When you get a problem is when you...
It's sound scans, right?
The shows are... All our shows, just so everybody knows, too, and your shows, too, they're all downloadable on iTunes. They're all downloadable from the website. And the best price, they're free. When you start selling them, then they'll come after you.
Gotcha. Well, I think I might have told you guys, I got hammered by Led Zeppelin's publishing company. For I was playing Nobody's Fault But Mine on my show, and I was commenting on how similar it is to Billy Squire's Lonely as the Night. It's really similar
to
lick.
That might have upset him.
but I learned later the way they do it is they have a thing called SoundScan. And there's just robots on YouTube and wherever else that are just going through the data files, and they pick up recognizable patterns. And that alerts some nerd who looks on his computer and says, hey, you're playing our copyrighted material.
Yeah, but is your YouTube channel have ads on it?
No, it's free. It's totally free.
Yours, because if you have ads, you're making money.
I got a cease and desist letter from Zeppelin's publishing company. And all I did was like play the lick seven or eight times. And I guess I played it well enough that SoundScan got it.
I know. Yeah. So I was going to say, I'm good because I can't play well enough to for them to catch it.
Maybe they didn't like the Billy Squire reference, but anyway, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. No, what I understood was that as long as you're not selling, because there's so many people that are doing sound alikes and stuff.
Well, I studied intellectual property.
It also might be because you're getting a lot of hits on your which is a good thing.
I know, but worst case scenario, somebody's going to go, oh, yeah, maybe I should go download Nobody's Fault But Mine.
Well, my guess is maybe because you're associating that song with your company. That would be maybe what they had a problem with.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer nerd, so.
So what we're gonna do is record music of our own for our own show, and
that's right.
Like we do everything, instead of pissing and moaning about what's wrong with the world, we're just gonna do our own little thing, and it'll be right.
Well,
you're a pretty accomplished guitar player. You play pretty good.
You're nice, Jeff. I appreciate.
And you got that 8-track.
I got this 8-track thing right here. It's great.
Right.
I'll show it to you.
So you got it. You can do the whole thing.
Yeah, we can do it. Well, the good news is for us, you know, I do my web show over at a really nice studio in Van Nuys. So, and the guy that runs the place, Brad Chasen, is a fantastic drummer. So we can cover the rest. We'll do really close versions. I used to study intellectual property in a past life. And I know that it's at 11 notes where you get into trouble. So we're going to do a lot of 10-note runs.
10-note runs.
That's good. Just remember
what Tommy Tedesco said, there's no money past the 5th fret.
Yeah, that's right.
So, just,
I only have 4 fingers that can play the guitar, so I'm good. So I can't play 4 notes.
I'm waiting for your daughter to start just doing like all these little tapping things and just become amazing.
You know, I play for her every day, so she's going to be a hell of a player.
No.
Well, maybe not, or she'll at least appreciate it.
Man, you got to do that. I played for my daughters when they were babies all the time.
I'm hoping someday she's going to listen to that Miley Cyrus song. Where's the guitar in this song?
Yeah, my kids do that.
She'll be doing your demos for you, so you'll be able to sit there and get all the camera angles and stuff.
Yeah.
My son just got his first guitar lesson. It was in San Jose at Showcase Guitars from Dick Wagner, the old Alice Cooper guitar player. He, 5 weeks old, he got his first guitar lessons. I don't think he got the theory so much, but the hands were amazing.
He can't quite get his thumb on the E string.
Oh, and you said something about tapping, and it reminded me that you're having Richie Kotzen on next week.
Yes.
I just saw Richie up in Sacramento with the Winery Dogs. It was amazing. I'm going to go see him tomorrow night at the Baked Potato. If anybody's in L.A., they ought to come and hang out.
So mention Gary Clark Jr. I think the Winery Dogs is probably one of the best bands that's come out in many years as a group band.
Another great power trio that came out this year that not enough people heard was Pinnock, Gales, and Pridgeon. Doug Pinnock from King's X, Gales.
Mm-hmm.
The album they put out, just remarkable. Just blew my mind. It was like... You know, it's
well, I'm looking forward to hearing those guys, you guys interviewing those guys, because I think I'm going to learn a lot about some new groups, because it's hard to find stuff. I mean, I used to go twice a month to Tower Records here. That was our local record. I used to sit there for 3 hours thumbing through, checking out stuff.
The big tower where
you don't
actually
have that anymore.
Preview records. And...
Yeah, you could listen to stuff, and that's where I learned a lot of new groups, you know, and found stuff. So maybe your show will get, open that door. We're almost at the end of the show, but there's one thing I want to ask, and I want to get all your information where people can get a hold of you, but also to end it, what do you were talking about looking at what the past was, the whole rock history, and what the future. So I want to know what your, both of you guys individually, what you think the future holds for rock music, for equipment, gear, whatever. And then also to give us your info, how to contact you.
Sure. Go ahead, Tony.
Gear's getting better. Technology's fabulous. The art itself is going to take longer. We're in a great period of, transformation. Things are changing. Everybody's crying about Spotify and iTunes, and I know they are the devil, but there's a way around the devil, and I've never seen the future as being brighter. Mm-hmm. I think, as always, I'm a big fan of saying the best is yet to come.
Cool.
Right on. I have a little different take on it, but I have a humble theory. I have a humble theory that I'll summarize as quickly as I can. I, in my estimation, the mainstream is not enjoying rock and roll because there's one crucial element that's gone from it now, that was in there forever, that made it what it used to be, and that is black music.
That's true. When metal came out, you lost a lot of the blues.
Black music is gone from rock and roll. And
Gary Clark Jr.
Right. Well.
Yeah.
But he's not mainstream.
No, but he will be if I can do anything about it here on the Flow.
Well, there used to be the powerful mix of black and white music. And that's what's kind of missing. And there's artists out there definitely doing it. But the mainstream, when you look at rock and roll, it's just white music, today. And when you look at black music, it's extremely black. And they're both great, but they don't blend anymore. And that's why it was rock and roll. Now it's just rock.
Yeah.
And it's a different thing. So I think the future is, I'm actually more hopeful than I say. We just kind of play that around. I think it's going to turn out fine. I think it's just going to take a couple of earthquakes in the business for that to happen. People are going to get tired of this lowest common denominator stuff that we're sort of being subjected to now, and we'll grow past it.
All right, so one speed question before we go for both of you guys, and it's kind of a modification of what I asked earlier. Who and what are, so it would be two answers. Who's the one person that is the most influential for rock and roll or changed rock and roll, and what item or what particular thing changed rock and roll most? Dan.
Well, the person, I'm going to stick with my earlier answer of Presley, because Presley's the guy that exposed black music to little white kids. And I think that was the crack in the ice.
Now, what's the one item that changed rock and roll?
Well, come on. It's got to be the electric guitar or the microphone.
Is there a specific electric guitar? Would it be the Telecaster, since it was the first solid body that came out, or would it be like a Strat?
Oh, man, that's a good question.
Or an LP.
That's sort of a Sophie's choice, because you got Chuck Berry playing, a 175 when he came out. You had Buddy Holly playing a Strat. You had, not too many rock guys played Tellys. I don't think a Telecaster became a rock and roll
guitar.
They
didn't know it. No, actually, Jimmy Page used all his leads were
Tellys. In the Yardbirds, that's true.
But, no, in Led Zeppelin. All his leads were Tellys.
Right.
Even though live, he used the Les Paul.
But I was going to say, it wasn't really till the late 60s or 70s that a Telly became mixed. It was always the country western Nashville thing.
So Tony, what would your answers be?
I was going to go with Chuck Berry and the Stratocaster.
There you go.
Because I thought Chuck kind of kicked it off for me, and mm-hmm. I think Jimmy changed it probably as much as anybody.
Can't argue with that either.
The Strat became the symbol of guitar after Hendrix.
So there's just to go off on my point for a second, there's two examples of guys that blended black and white music. You had Elvis Presley, who everyone thought was black until they saw a picture of him. Then you have Chuck Berry, that everyone thought was white until they saw a picture of him. So Chuck Berry's singing country lyrics. Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? That's not a blues tune. Cadillac rolling on 95, that's not a blues song. Right, and Elvis Presley singing about heartache and infidelity, but those two guys blended those two elements really, really well. The Beatles came over playing black music and killed it. It's every one of these big artists were able to blend that, and that was what made these earthquakes. So I think we're ready for an earthquake. I'm hoping for one. I'm a hopeful agnostic, I guess is the way to put it. Like, man, I don't see it, but I sure will be the first in line when it happens.
That's cool. Now, before we go, give us information, contact information.
Dan at 65amps.com, or I'm on Facebook as Dan Buell, and that's B-O-U-L.
Okay.
Easiest for me is just Google me at Rock Guitar Daily.
Rock Guitar Daily, okay.
All right, and for our folks next week, a huge show next week, we have Richie Kotzen, a Telecaster player, rock and roll Telecaster player, in studio. And he'll be here with an amp, guitar, and hopefully some loud music.
And I look forward to December 7th, 8 p.m. on Saturdays, Rock Ain't Near Dead Radio. This is going to be cool. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll see
Such
you next
an
week.
It's an honor to be here. Great we time. Appreciate it.